4. Jean Tannon sat reading in a private booth at the Gilded Cloister, a club on the second tier of the Savrola, just a few blocks down from the Villa Candessa. The cloister was a labyrinth of dark wood enclosures, well padded with leather and quilting, for the benefit of diners wishing an unusual degree of solitude. The waitstaff, in their leather aprons and drooping red caps, were forbidden to speak, answering all customer requests with either a nod or a shake of the head. Jean's dinner, smoked rock eel in caramel brandy sauce, lay chopped into fragments and scattered like debris from a battle. He was making his way slowly through dessert, a cluster of marzipan dragonflies with crystallized sugar wings that glimmered by the steady glow of the booth's candles. He was absorbed in a leather-bound copy of Lucarno's Tragedy of the 10 Honest Turncoats, and he didn't notice Locke until the smaller man was already seated across from him in the booth.
"Leo Canto, you gave me a start. Jerome,"
they both spoke in a near whisper.
"You really were nervous, weren't you? Nose buried in a book to keep you from going mad. Some things never change."
"I wasn't nervous. I was merely reasonably concerned."
"You needn't have been."
"Is it done, then? Am I successfully betrayed?"
"Quite betrayed. Absolutely sold out. A dead man walking."
"Wonderful. And his attitude?"
"Guarded. Ideal, I'd say. Had he been too enthusiastic, I would be worried. And had he not been enthusiastic at all, well..."
Locke mimicked, shoving a knife into his chest and wiggling it several times.
"Is this smoked eel?"
"Help yourself. It's stuffed with apricots and soft yellow onions. Not entirely to my taste."
Locke took up Jean's fork and helped himself to a few bites of the eel. He was more partial to the stuffing than Jean had been.
"We're going to lose 2/3 of my account, it seems,"
he said after making some progress on the dish.
"A tax on cheating to remind me not to presume too much on Requin's patience." "Well, it's not as though we expected to get out of the city with the money in those accounts. Might have been nice to have it for a few more weeks, at least." "True. But I think the alternative would have been desktop surgery, whether I needed a hand amputated or not. What are you reading?"
Jean showed him the title, and Locke feigned choking.
"Lucarno? Why is it always Lucarno? You drag him everywhere we go. His damn romances. Your brains will go soft with that mush. You'll end up more fit for tending flower gardens than for running confidence games."
"Well," said Jean, "I shall be sure to criticize your reading habits, Master Costa, should I ever see you develop any."
"I've read quite a bit."
"History and biography, mostly what Chains prescribed for you."
"What could possibly be wrong with those subjects?"
"As for history, we are living in its ruins. And as for biographies, we are living with the consequences of all the decisions ever made in them. I tend not to read them for pleasure. It's not unlike carefully scrutinizing the map when one has already reached the destination."
"But romances aren't real, and surely never were. Doesn't that take away some of the savour?"
"What an interesting choice of words. Not real and never were. Could there be any more appropriate literature for men of our profession? Why are you always so averse to fiction when we've made it our meal ticket?"
"I live in the real world," said Locke, "and my methods are of the real world. They are, just as you say, a profession, a practicality, not some romantic whim."
Jean set the book down before him and tapped its cover.
"This is where we're headed, Thorne. Or at least you are. Look for us in history books and you'll find us in the margins. Look for us in legends and you might just find us celebrated."
"Exaggerated, you mean? Lied about, trumped up or stamped down? The truth of anything we do will die with us and nobody else will ever have a bloody clue."
"Better that than obscurity.
I recall you once had quite a taste for drama. For plays, if nothing else." Yes. Locke folded his hands on the table and lowered his voice even further. And you know what happened to it.
Forgive me, said Jean with a sigh. I should have known better than to bring up that particular red-headed subject once again.
A waiter appeared at the entrance to the little booth, looking attentively at Locke.
Oh, no, said Locke, and set Jean's fork back on the eel plate. Nothing for me, I'm afraid. I'm just here waiting for my friend to finish his little candy wasps.
Dragonflies. Jean popped the last one into his mouth, swallowed it nearly whole, and tucked his book away within his coat.
Give over the bill, and I'll settle up with you.
The waiter nodded, cleared away the used dishes, and left a scrap of paper pinned to a small wooden tablet.
Well, said Locke as Jean counted copper coins from his purse, we've no responsibilities for the rest of the evening. Requin is no doubt setting eyes on us as we speak. I think a night or two of light relaxation would be in order to avoid upsetting him.
Great, said Jean. Why don't we wander around a bit, and maybe catch a boat over to the Emerald Galleries? They've got coffee houses there, and music. Would it be in character for Leo and Jerome to get a bit tipsy and chase tavern dancers?
Jerome can murder as much ale as he likes and bother tavern dancers until the sun chases us home to bed. Leo will sit and watch the festivities.
Maybe play Spot the Shadow with Requin's people?
Maybe.
Damn, I wish we had Bug to lurk on a few rooftops for us. We could use a pair of top eyes. There's not a trustworthy one in this damned city.
I wish we still had Bug, period, said Jean with a sigh.
They made their way to the foyer of the club, chatting quietly of imaginary business between Masters Costa and De Ferrer, batting little improvisations back and forth for the sake of any prying ears. It was just after midnight when they stepped out into the familiar quiet order and high walls of the Savrola. The place was artificially clean. No knackers here, no blood in the alleys, no piss in the gutters. The grey brick streets were well lit by silvery lanterns in swaying iron frames. The whole district seemed framed in bright moonlight, though the sky tonight was occluded by a high ceiling of dark clouds. The woman was waiting for them in the shadows on Locke's left. She matched pace with him as he and Jean moved down the street. One of Locke's sleeve stilettos fell into the palm of his hand before he could control the reflex, but she stayed a full yard away, with her hands folded behind her back. She was youngish, short and slender, with dark hair pulled back into a long tail. She wore a vaguely fashionable dark coat and a four-cornered hat with a long grey silk scarf that trailed behind her like a ship's pennant as she walked.
Leocanto Costa, she said in a pleasant, even voice. I know you and your friend are armed. Let's not be difficult.
I beg your pardon, madam?
Move that blade in your hand, and it's a shaft through the neck for you. Tell your friend to keep his hatchets under his coat. Let's just keep walking.
Jean began to move his left hand beneath his coat. Locke caught him with his right hand and swiftly shook his head. They were not alone on the street. People hurried here and there on business or pleasure, but some of them were staring at him and Jean. Some of them were standing in alleys and shadows, wearing unseasonably heavy cloaks, unmoving.
Shit,
Jean muttered.
Rooftops.
Locke glanced up briefly. Across the street, atop the 3- and 4-story stone buildings, he could see the silhouettes of at least 2 men moving slowly along with them, carrying thin, curved objects in their hands. Longbows.
You appear to have us at a disadvantage, madam, said Locke, slipping his stiletto into a coat pocket and showing her his empty hand. To what do we owe the pleasure of your attention?
Someone wants to have a conversation with you.
Clearly they knew where to find us. Why not simply join us for dinner?
Conversation should be private, don't you think?
Did a man in a rather tall tower send you?
She smiled, but said nothing. A moment later, she gestured ahead of them. At the next corner, take a left. You'll see an open door, first building on your right. Go there. Follow directions. Sure enough, the promised open door was waiting just past the next crossroads, a rectangle of yellow light casting a pale twin across the ground. The woman went in first. Locke, conscious of the presence of at least 4 or 5 nearby lurkers in addition to the rooftop archers, sighed and passed Jean a quick hand signal. Easy, easy. The place looked like a shop, disused but otherwise in good repair. There were 6 more people inside the room, men and women in silver-banded leather doublets with their backs up against the walls. 4 of them held loaded crossbows, which neatly quashed any thoughts of resistance Locke might have been teasing around inside his head. Even Jean couldn't balance those odds. One of the crossbowmen quietly closed the door, and the woman who'd led Locke and Jean in turned. The front of her coat fell open, and Locke could see that she too was wearing reinforced leather armor. She held out her hands. "Weapons," she said, politely but firmly. "Smartly now." When Locke and Jean glanced at each other, she laughed. "Don't be dense, gentlemen. If we wanted you dead, you'd already be pinned to the wall. I'll take good care of your property for you." Slowly, resignedly, Locke shook his 2 stilettos out of his coat, and Jean followed suit with his matched pair of hatchets and no fewer than 3 daggers of his own. "I do like men who travel prepared," said the woman. She passed their weapons to one of the men behind her and drew 2 lightweight cloth hoods out of her coat. She tossed 1 to Locke and 1 to Jean. "On over your heads, please. Then we can get on with our business."
"Why?"
Jean sniffed at his hood suspiciously, and Locke followed suit. The cloth seemed to be clean.
"For your own protection. Do you really want your faces out in the open if we drag you through the streets under guard?"
"I suppose not," said Locke.
Frowning, he slipped the hood on and found that it put him in total darkness. There was a sound of footsteps and the swirl of moving coats. Strong hands seized Locke's arms and forced them together behind his back. A moment later, he felt something being woven tightly around his wrists. There was a louder tumult and a number of irritated grunts from beside him. Presumably, they had ganged up on Jean in heavy numbers.
"There," came the voice of the woman, now behind Locke. "Now step lively. Don't worry about falling over. You'll be assisted."
By assisted, she clearly meant that they'd be seized and carried along by the arms. Locke felt hands close around his biceps, and he cleared his throat.
"Where are we going?"
"For a boat ride, Master Costa," said the woman. "Don't ask any more questions, because I won't answer them. Let's be on our way."
There was a creak as the door was thrown open once again, and a brief whirling sensation as he was pushed around and reoriented by the people holding him. Then they were moving back out into the muggy Ferrari night, and Locke could feel heavy beads of sweat begin to slide their ticklish paths down his forehead. Reminiscence. Best Laid Plans. 1.
"Shit!"
said Locke, as the deck of cards exploded outward from his sore left hand. Jean flinched back from the blizzard of paper that fluttered around the compartment of the carriage.
"Try again," said Jean. "Perhaps the 18th time's the charm."
"I used to be so damned good at this one-handed shuffle." Locke began plucking up cards and reorganizing them into a neat pile. "I bet I could do it better than Carlo and Galdo, even. Damn, my hand aches."
"Well, I know I pushed you to exercise," said Jean, "but you were a little out of practice even before you got hurt. Give it time."
A hard rain was falling around the jouncing black luxury carriage as it threaded its way along the old Therin Throne Road through the foothills just east of the Tal Varar coast. A hunched, middle-aged woman worked the reins of the six-horse team from her open box atop the cabin, with the cowl of her oil cloak pulled forward to protect the smouldering bowl of her pipe. Two outrider guards huddled in misery on the rear footboard, secured by wide leather straps around their waists. Jean was peering over a sheaf of notes, flipping parchment pages back and forth, muttering to himself. The rain was beating hard against the right side of the closed cabin, but they were able to keep the left-hand window open, with its mesh screens and leather shutters drawn back to admit muggy air that smelled of manured fields and salt marshes. A little yellow alchemical globe on the padded seat beside Jean provided reading light. They were 2 weeks out from Velverazzo, a good 100 miles to the northwest, and well past the need to paint themselves up with apple mash to move freely. "Here's what all my sources say," said Jean when Locke had finished recovering all of his cards. "Requin's somewhere in his 40s. Native Varari, but he speaks a bit of Vadran, and supposedly he's a genius at Throne Therin. He's an art collector, mad about the painters and sculptors from the very last years of the Empire. Nobody knows what he did prior to 20 years ago. Apparently he won the Sinspire on a bet and threw the previous owner out a window."
"And he's tight with a priori?"
"Most of them, it seems."
"Any idea how much he keeps in his vaults?"
"Conservative estimate," said Jean. "At least enough to pay out any debts the house might incur. He could never allow himself to be embarrassed in that respect. So let's say 50,000 solari at least, plus his personal fortune, plus the combined goods and fortunes of a great many people. He doesn't pay interest like the best counting houses, but he doesn't keep transaction ledgers for the taxmen either. Supposedly, he has one book, hidden gods know where, amended only by his own hand. This is mostly hearsay, of course."
"That 50,000 doesn't cover anything but the house's operating funds, right? So how much do you presume the total contents of his vault would be worth?"
"It's pure entrail reading, without the entrails even, but 300,000? 350?
Seems reasonable."
"Yes, well, the details on the vault itself are much more solid. Apparently Requin doesn't mind letting some of the facts get out. Thinks it dissuades thieves."
"They always do, don't they?"
"In this case, they may be onto something. Listen, the Sinspire is nearly 60 yards high, one thick elderglass cylinder. You know about those. You tried to jump off one about 2 months ago. Goes down another 100 feet or so into a glass hill. It's got one door at street level, and exactly one door into the vault beneath the tower. One. No secrets, no side entrances. The ground is pristine elderglass. No tunneling through it, not in 1,000 years. Requin's got at least 4 attendants on each floor at any given time, plus dozens of table minders, card dealers, and waiters. There's a lounge on the 3rd floor where he keeps more out of sight. So figure, at a minimum, 50 or 60 loyal workers on duty, with another 20 to 30 he can call out. Lots of nasty brutes, too. He likes to recruit from ex-soldiers, mercenaries, city thieves, and such. He gives cushy positions to his right people for jobs well done, and he pays them like he was their doting mother. Plus, there are stories of dealers getting a year's wages in tips from lucky blue bloods in just a night or two. Bribery won't be likely to work on anyone." "He's got 3 layers of vault doors, all of them iron-shod witchwood, 3 or 4 inches thick. Last set of doors is supposedly backed with blackened steel. So even if you had a week to chop through the other two, you'd never get past the 3rd. All of them have clockwork mechanisms, the best and most expensive Varari stuff, private designs from masters of the Artificers Guild. The standing orders are, not one set of doors opens unless he's there himself to see it. He watches every deposit and every withdrawal.
opens the doors a couple times per day at most. Behind the first set of doors are 4 to 8 guards, in rooms with cots, food and water. They can hold out there for a week under siege. The inner sets of doors don't open except for a key he keeps around his neck. The outer doors won't open except for a key he always gives to his majordomo. So you'd need them both to get anywhere. And the traps. They're demented, or at least the rumors are. Pressure plates, counterweights, crossbows in the walls and ceilings, contact poisons, sprays of acid, chambers full of venomous serpents or spiders. One fellow even said that there's a chamber before the last door that fills up with a cloud of powdered strangler's orchid petals, and while you're choking to death on that, a bit of twist match falls out and lights the whole mess on fire, so then you burn to a crisp. Insult to injury. Worst of all, the inner vault is guarded by a live dragon, attended by 50 naked women armed with poisoned spears, each of them sworn to die in Requin's service. All redheads.
You're just making that up, Jean.
I wanted to see if you were listening. But what I'm saying is, I don't care if he's got 1 million solari in there, packed in bags for easy hauling. I'm inclined to the idea that this vault might not be breakable. Not unless you've got 300 soldiers, 6 or 7 wagons, and a team of master clockwork artificers you're not telling me about.
Right.
Do you have 300 soldiers, 6 or 7 wagons, and a team of master clockwork artificers you're not telling me about?
No. I've got you, me, the contents of our coin purses, this carriage, and a deck of cards.
He attempted a complicated manipulation of the cards, and they erupted out of his hand yet again, scattering against the opposite seat.
Fuck me with a pole axe!
Then if I might persist, Lord of Legerdemain, perhaps there's some other target in Talvarar we might consider.
I'm not sure that'd be wise. Talvarar's got no twit-riddled aristocracy for us to fool around with. The Archon's a military tyrant on a long leash. He can bend the laws as he sees fit, so I'd rather not yank his breech clout. The Priori Council is all merchants from common stock, and they'll be damned hard to cheat. There's plenty of likely subjects for small-time games, but if we want a big game, Requin's the best one to hit. He's got what we want, right there for the taking.
Yet his vault...
Let me tell you, said Locke, exactly what we're going to do about his vault.
Locke spoke for a few minutes while he put his deck of cards together, outlining the barest details of his scheme. Jean's eyebrows strained upward, attempting to take to the air above his head.
So that's that. Now what do you say, Jean?
I'll be damned. That might just work. If...
If?
Are you sure you remember how to work a climbing harness? I'm a bit rusty myself.
We'll have quite a while to practice, won't we?
Hopefully. And we'll need a carpenter. One outside Talvarar itself, obviously.
We can go looking into that as well, once we've got a bit of coin back in our pockets.
Jean sighed, and all the banter went out of him like wine from a punctured skin. I suppose that just leaves... Damn.
What?
Well, hell. Are you going to break down on me again? Are you going to stay reliable?
Stay reliable? Jean, you can... Damn it, look for yourself. What have I been doing? Exercising, planning, and apologizing all the damn time. I'm sorry, Jean, I really am. Vel Virazzo was a bad time. I miss Carlo, Galdo, and Bug.
As do I, but...
I know. I let my sorrow get the best of me. It was damned selfish, and I know you must ache like I do. I said some stupid things, but I thought I'd been forgiven.
Did I misunderstand? Locke's voice hardened. Shall I now understand that forgiveness is something prone to going in and out like the tide? Now that's hardly fair. Just what? Am I special, Jean? Am I our only liability? When have I ever doubted your skills? When have I ever treated you like a child? You're not my fucking mother, and you're certainly not Chains. We can't work as partners if you're going to sit in judgment of me like this. The two of them stared at each other, each trying to muster an attitude of cold indignation, and each failing. The mood within the little cabin turned morose, and Jean turned to stare sullenly out the window for a few moments, while Locke dejectedly shuffled his cards. He attempted another one-handed cut, and neither he nor Jean seemed surprised when a little blizzard of paper chits settled into the seat beside Jean. "I'm sorry," Locke said as his cards fluttered down. "That was another shitty thing to say. Gods, when did we discover how easy it is to be cruel to one another?" "You're right," Jean said softly. "I'm not Chains, and I'm certainly not your mother. I shouldn't push you." "No, you should. You pushed me off that galleon, and you pushed me out of Velverazzo. You were right. I behaved terribly, and I can understand if you're still nervous about me. I was so wrapped up in what I'd lost, I forgot what I still had. I'm glad you still worry enough about me to kick my ass when I need it." "Look, I apologize as well. I just..." "Damn it, don't interrupt me when I'm feeling virtuously self-critical. I'm ashamed of how I behaved in Velverazzo. It was a slight to everything we've been through together. I promise to do better. Does that put you at ease?"
"Yes. Yes, it does."
Jean began to pick up the scattered cards, and the ghost of a smile appeared on his face. Locke settled back in his seat and rubbed his eyes.
"Gods, we need a target, Jean. We need a game. We need someone to go to work on as a team. Don't you see? It's not just about what we can charm out of Requin. I want it to be us against the world, lively and dangerous, just like it used to be. Where there's no room for this sort of second-guessing, you know?"
"Because we're constantly inches from a horrible bloody death, you mean?"
"Right, the good times."
"This plan might take a year," said Jean slowly. "Maybe two. For a game this interesting, I'm willing to spend a year or two. You have any other pressing engagements?"
Jean shook his head, passed the collected cards back to Locke, and went back to his sheaf of notes, a deeply thoughtful expression on his face. Locke slowly traced the outline of the deck of cards with the fingers of his left hand, which felt slightly less useful than a crab claw. He could feel the still fresh scars itching beneath his cotton tunic, scars so extensive it looked as though most of his left side had been sewn together from rag parts. Gods damn it, he was ready to be healed now. He was ready to have his old careless agility back. He imagined that he felt like a man of twice his years. He tried another one-handed shuffle, and the deck fell apart in his hands. At least it hadn't shot apart in all directions. Was that improvement? He and Jean were silent for several minutes. Eventually, the carriage rattled around a final small hill, and suddenly Locke was looking across a green checkerboard land, sloping downward to sea cliffs perhaps 5 or 6 miles distant. Specks of grey and white and black dotted the landscape, thickening toward the horizon, where the land side of Tal Verar crowded against the cliff edges. The coastal section of the city seemed pressed down beneath the rain. Great silvery curtains were sweeping past behind it, blotting out the islands of Tal Verar proper. Lightning crackled blue and white in the distance, and soft peals of thunder rolled toward them across the fields.
"We're here," said Locke.
"Landside," said Jean, without looking up. "Might as well find an inn when we get there. We'll be hard-pressed to find a boat to the islands in weather like this."
Who shall we be when we get there?
Jean looked up and chewed his lip before taking the bait of their old game. Let's be something other than Camorri for a while. Camorra's brought us nothing good of late.
Talishani?
Seems good to me. Jean adjusted his voice slightly, adopting the faint but characteristic accent of the city of Talisham.
Anonymous Unknown of Talisham, and his associate Unknown Anonymous, also of Talisham.
What names did we leave on the books at Maraggio's?
Well, Lucas Fairwhite and Ivanti Ikari are right out. Even if those accounts haven't been confiscated by the state, they'll be watched.
You trust the spider not to get a burr up her arse if she finds out we're active in Tal Vahrar?
No, said Locke. I seem to recall Jerome de Ferra, Leocanto Costa, and Milo Varalin.
I opened the Milo Varalin account myself. He's supposed to be Vadran. I think we might leave him in reserve.
And that's what we have left? 3 useful accounts?
Sadly, yes. But it's more than most thieves get. I'll be Jerome.
I suppose I'll be Leocanto, then. What are we doing in Tal Vahrar, Jerome?
We're hired men for a Lashani countess. She's thinking of buying a summer home in Tal Vahrar, and we're there to hunt one down for her.
That might be good for a few months, but after we've looked at all the available properties, then what? And there's lots of actual work involved if we don't want everyone to know right away that we're lying through our teeth. What if we call ourselves merchant speculators?
Merchant speculators.
That's good. It doesn't have to mean a damn thing.
Exactly. If we spend all our time lounging around the chance houses cutting cards, well, we're just passing time, waiting for market conditions to ripen.
Or we're so good at our jobs we hardly need to work at all.
Our lines write themselves.
How do we meet, and how long have we been together?
We met 5 years ago.
Jean scratched his beard. On a sea voyage. We became business partners out of sheer boredom. Since then, we've been inseparable.
Except that my plan calls for me to be plotting your death.
Yes, but I don't know that, do I?
Boon companion, I suspect nothing.
Chump, I can hardly wait to see you get yours.
And the loot? Assuming we do manage to work our way into Requin's confidence, and we do manage to call the dance properly, and we do manage to get out of his city with everything intact, we haven't really talked about what comes after that.
We'll be old thieves, Jean.
Locke squinted and tried to pick out details of the rain-swept landscape as the carriage made its final turn down the long, straight road into Tal Vahrar.
Old thieves of 27, or perhaps 28 when we finish this.
I don't know.
How would you feel about becoming a viscount?
Lashane, Jean mused. Buy a pair of titles, you mean? Settle there for good?
Not sure if I'd go that far, but last I heard, poor titles were running about 10,000 solari, and better ones 15 to 20. It'd give us a home and some clout. We could do whatever we wanted from there. Plot more games, grow old in comfort.
Retirement?
We can't run around false-facing forever, Jean. I think we both realize that. Sooner or later, we'll need to favor another style of crime. Let's tease a nice big score out of this place, and then sink it into something useful. Build something again. Whatever comes after, well, we can charm that lock when we come to it.
Viscount Anonymous Unknown of Lashane, and his neighbour Viscount Unknown Anonymous.
There are worse fates, I suppose.
There certainly are, Jerome. So are you with me?
Of course, Leocanto.
You know that. Maybe another 2 years of honest thieving will leave me ready to retire. I could get back into silks and shipping like mother and father. Perhaps look up some of their old contacts, if I can remember them right.
I think Tal Varar will be good for us, said Locke. It's a pristine city. We've never worked out of it, and it's never seen our like. Nobody knows us, nobody expects us. We'll have total freedom of movement.
The carriage clattered along under the rain, jostling against patches where the weathered stones of the Therin Throne Road had been washed clean of their protective layers of dirt. Lightning lit the sky in the distance, but the grey veil swirled thick between land and sea, and the great mass of Tal Varar was hidden from their eyes as they rode down into it for the first time.
You're almost certainly right, Locke. I think we do need a game.
Jean set his notes on his lap and cracked his knuckles.
Gods, but it'll be good to be out and around. It'll be good to be the predators again.